Hey guys, turkey season is in full swing right now, and if you are planning on getting after it, make sure to pick up some Meat Eater Phelps turkey calls to stuff into the old turkey vest or into your fanny pack right now. I carry a few different things. I like to use mouth calls, and I like to use pot calls. Mouth calls or diaphragms, I like them because it gives you hand-free calling, meaning when you're working a bird up close, you can have your gun on your knee, finger on the trigger, ready to roll, and still be making turkey sounds. I like pot calls because I just like pot calls. I enjoy calling with a pot call. Whatever direction you go, including a box call, which I don't personally use too much, but they're fun and great, and I started out with them. Yanni, on the other hand, one of my main turkey hunting buddies, he loves box calls. And what's funny is I'll now and then look to him and give him the look that means get out your box call and find us a turkey. So it's not that I don't like him. I just have Yanni use his. Then I don't have to carry it. Go to Phelps Game Calls. Get calls that are made in the USA and get calls that'll get them close. Find yours at PhelpsGameCalls.com today.
Welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast, your home for deer hunting news, stories, and strategies. And now, your host, Mark Kenyon.
Welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast. I'm your host, Mark Kenyon, and this is episode number 294. And today on the show, I'm joined by freelance writer and whitetail hunter Pat Durkin to get back to the basics of whitetail deer and how they see, hear, smell, and survive. Welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast, brought to you by Onyx. And today on the show, I'm joined by Pat Durkin, who is an outdoor writer and avid deer hunter. And I want to have him on the show to discuss deer themselves, not just, you know, all the fancy strategies to chase them and the gear to help us kill them, but actually just talk about these animals and how they do what they do. And I thought Pat would be the perfect guy to do this because he's an actual journalist. He doesn't just whip up an article based off of his own crazy ideas like I do sometimes. He actually meticulously researches his topics and he consults multiple experts and then reports back on what the science says or what the real data says. And with that has come a fascinating insight into what makes white-tailed deer tick. So that's what we're chatting with Pat about today. All that he's learned over the years about deer as he's researched and study these creatures, stuff like how they see and how they smell and how they hear and lots more. So with no introduction today, we're just going to get right into it. So let's take a quick break to thank a couple partners and then we will get chatting with Pat. All right. I'm excited to have on the line with me today, Pat Durkin. Welcome to the show, Pat.
Hey, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I really, really appreciate it. It's been fun over the last, year or two to get to chat every once in a while as you're working on different articles and things and with your involvement with Meat Eater now. But this will be our first chance to do an extended, long conversation. So thank you for doing this.
Well, you bet. I was looking forward to it for the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, me too. And I guess what brought you to mind for me as someone who I thought we should have a chat with is that so often when you look out there in today's hunting media or even listen to podcasts or even sometimes this podcast, we get so hyper excited about the latest and greatest strategy, some new trick, some new trend, whatever it might be. But when I go and I look at so many of your recent things that you're writing and focusing on now, you do a great job of bringing things back to what really matters the most, which is the animal itself and research about the animal. And I don't know, you just have this extremely deep well of information and experience with deer, given your background. And then you do such an interesting job of talking to other people that research deer that you just get these perspectives that I think are really, really helpful. So I kind of want to talk about a lot of things related to that. But before we get into deer, I do want to make sure we lay a little bit of groundwork for people who maybe aren't familiar with you, which would be shocking if they're not. But if they are new to Pat Durkin, can you give us the cliff notes on kind of how you got to this point, what you've done in the deer world, and what you're doing now?
Yeah, the thing I'd say, too, is I've never hurt or whatever insults of people haven't heard of me, because the one thing I've always known about writing, reporting, is that most people don't read bylines. And this goes back to my days. I started at the Oshkosh Northwestern newspaper in East Central Wisconsin back in 1982 when I was still in college. And I always remember the first thing I wrote for the college newspaper back then was a column about, I think it was about hunting or fishing. I can't even remember anymore. But anyway, the thing I remember about it, Mark, is that when I went to, I was all proud and happy about getting my first piece of writing published. But then I went to, when I went to back to the newspaper office that next day, I remember seeing somebody had used the newspaper as a door jam to keep the door from locking behind them. And it was just coincidentally, they'd punched, you know, the little door knob part sticks in, you know, the little clasp sticks into the door. Right at that point is where my face was. It was punched right through. And I always kept that in mind that
very humbly,
people have many uses for newspapers.
Yeah.
And you're quickly forgotten and you're often overlooked. You know, so I'm not hurt at all when people say, I never heard of you until this or that. You know, and even today I write a lot of stuff and I've had people quite often tell me, I was reading this article the other day and they start describing the article. And I'll say, yeah, I wrote that. And it's happened so often in my career where you just cannot have a, it keeps you humble. It keeps, you know, I realize there's many people out there who have much higher profiles than I do. And I just don't worry about it too much. But to finish my little bio real quickly, I worked in the Oshkosh newspaper for 8 years. And I was mainly I did all sorts of jobs. I covered school boards. I covered high school sports. And my whole thing, though, was that I always wanted to get into the outdoors beat. So the reason I was in sports for the first couple of years is because sports editors in those days always controlled the outdoors page. And most newspapers, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, had at least an outdoor page once a week. And I always realized that, well, if I want to get on that page and write for that paper, I need to learn the sports editor's name and work with him. So that's kind of how I got going on. And then eventually I did other things in the newspaper. I was always doing the outdoors, but I also did things like on the school board. I also covered City Hall a little bit and the police and fire type things. You go out and have to cover, you know, spot news. So it was really a good background for reporting. And then along the way, one of my little breakthroughs, I guess, was I learned that one of the best sources for conservation information in our region was a guy named Al Hofacker. And Al was the editor of Deer and Deer Hunting magazine, that the original, one of the original founders of it. He and Jack Brower founded the magazine back in the late 70s, and it was just up the road in Appleton, Wisconsin. And by the time I came around at a newspaper, these guys had Deer and Deer Hunting magazine rolling as a national magazine. And so I would interview Al on various conservation issues going on in the area because he was always a real good citizen, always involved in things. And eventually they must have been reading my stuff and how I covered the issues that Al was involved in, because they brought me up one time for an interview in about late 1990. And then I started working for them 2 or 3 weeks later. And that, you know, got me into the hunting industry, basically. And so I worked at Deer and Deer Hunting magazine for 11 years. I was its editor for most of that time. And along the way, you know, one thing I didn't know at the time, Mark, which I always look back on with a lot of fascination, was that I didn't realize it, but each time I was taking these jobs, first at newspapers, then at magazines, I was kind of riding the tail end of a big deal. Newspapers were still, you know, really strong going into the 80s, and by the end of the 80s, they were starting to tail off. And the magazines were kind of doing the same thing during the 90s. You know, our magazine circulation peaked in about 1989, 1990. And by the time I left in 2001, it had been on a steady downhill climb. No matter how hard I worked, no matter how much effort I put into it, things were sliding. And by the time I left in 2001, you know, the internet was starting to come along and people were spending more time doing online stuff, and even things as basic as email newsletters were getting a little popularity. So all along the way, I was kind of, without realizing it, jumping one step ahead of the the downward curve. So by the time I got in the freelancing, you know, like about 20 years ago, I was pretty well situated to do freelance work. I had a lot of contacts. I knew people in the academic world that were doing a lot of deer research. And so that really served me well when I started freelancing. And that's what I've been doing now for since 2001, late 2001. And so I do a lot of work with the Archery Trade Association still. I'm kind of their chief copy editor. And I still write my weekly newspaper column, and I've been writing for Meat Eater now the last year and a half. And I write regular articles for American Hunter magazine. And so I stay really busy.
So you've been writing about or reporting on deer and hunting-related topics for, what would you say, 30 years, more than that?
Yeah. You know, I've been. I think one of my first articles in the outdoors is a fishing article on some local tournament guy. And then after that, one thing I always look back on with a lot of pride is that even though I was an outdoor reporter and doing things from everything from fishing reports to, you know, weekly fishing reports to just covering conservation meetings, the thing that I always took time for, I'd take vacation for every year, was deer hunting up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, which is only about a 3.5-hour drive from where I've lived, you know, in central Wisconsin now for, you know, many years. And so that was a big part of my, when I took vacation during my newspaper days, I almost always spent at least a week up in the UP during the gun season, which always opens November 15th. And so that was really a cool thing to do, just, and it kind of got me interested in something that, one thing I should say, Mark, is one thing that always fascinates me about deer hunting was always the people side of it. I always loved things like the deer camp stories, the things that kind of brought people together and got them hunting. And I always enjoyed reading about the long time ago deer hunters. And the most influential book for me growing up is, you know, when I first started hunting, I was about 14. I always remember reading Larry Kohler's book, Shots at Whitetails, and it's been a book I've kept in my library ever since. And, you know, it's just, to me, it's fun to kind of go back and read every now and then, because, you know, it wasn't, they weren't doing things like hunting scrapes, they weren't worrying about rub lines, all these things that we've kind of taken into a big part of our strategy sessions. They did drives, and they did still hunting. And stand hunting, that was about it. You know? And so that's kind of my history. I just I love all that. It gets the researchers call it human dimensions.
Yeah, that is fascinating stuff. On the topic of books, are there any other of those classic books that you still point to as something you recommend to folks, or that you like to grab off your shelf every once in a while and look at? I remember finding, I was up at my family deer camp this, I guess it would have been earlier this spring, and at the bottom of a stack underneath the table was one of the original books from the, I never know if it's Benoit or Benoit brothers, but I think it was How to Bag a Trophy Buck. Yeah, the Benoits.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
It was really old and falling apart, but I was like, wow, this is pretty cool. This is like 30 years old, and this is what my grandpa was reading when I was a baby. That was kind of neat to see. Are there any books like that you still look at and point people towards?
That one there is really a classic, you know, Larry Benoit's book. I still have my copy from, I think it was part of the Outdoor Life book club back in the 70s. Yeah, probably like mid-70s, late 70s. And one of the cool things about working at Deer and Deer Hunting magazine during the 90s was they had a book division at the publishing house that then owned Deer and Deer Hunting magazine. So I was able to bring back and kind of update a little bit, like Shots at Whitetails. We did our own edition of Shots at Whitetails. And we tried to get permission from Larry Benoit to redo his original book, you know, the How to Get the Biggest Buck of Your Life, or whatever it was called.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, How to Bag the Biggest Buck of Your Life, I think, was the title.
Yeah.
And it was just a real straightforward book about his still hunting and how his family would, you know, go out, you know, and get on a track and basically stalk, you know, deer based on what they saw, the hoof print. And it was one of those unfortunate things where, you know, we're we want to reprint the book, but then there's just too much, too many obligations and too many past differences between Larry and the co-author at the time, and we just couldn't make it work. So, but then we came up with an alternative where a writer named Bryce Towsley spent some time with Larry and his family, and did, I think they did one or two more books, I think, with the Benoists in, during the 1990s, early 2000s. So, in fact, I during that process, I sent my copy of the original Benoit book to Larry and asked him to sign it for me. And it was it's kind of a curious thing. He wrote back to me, sent the book back, a nice little wrote a nice little tribute to me. And then he said something like, "I'm sorry you couldn't take time to stop by and visit when you're in Vermont last week or that last summer." And I don't know who he confused me with, but I've never been to Vermont in my life. So it's one of those fun things you know that happened to you once in a while, where someone for whatever reason confuses you with someone else. And so I have that inscription on my Larry Benoit book.
That's great. So speaking of then these classic books, these classic resources that so many people looked on, I do feel like you have now gotten your own fingerprints on many of the resources and things that people are now looking back on that aren't that old at all or even new now to get this new foundation. With people today, I think new hunters that are trying to learn about deer and deer hunting, if they're turning to Meat Eater right now, for example, or many other places that your Definitely. Written works are at, they're yeah. seeing some really good foundational deer-related content that I've really loved from you. You've done a handful of pieces now. Yeah, of course. You've done a handful of pieces now kind of examining whitetail 101 kind of biology, some about the senses mm-hmm. of deer. And I want to kind of start there because we very sure. rarely ever talk about that anymore. It's always like how to find the best pinch point, or how can you track, you know, trail camera data and find patterns and so on and so forth. We never rewind back to the beginning and start talking about, like, what can these deer smell? What can they see? What should mm-hmm. we be thinking about? So that's kind of where I wanted to start, Pat. Let's talk about a deer's senses. You asked me this question a couple months ago, and I want to get right back to you, which is, how would you rank a deer's senses from most important or most beneficial to them down to the bottom?
Well, I should say, and I mean this real sincerely, Mark, is the one thing I've liked about my career, the things that I find interesting, is that one thing I've learned along the way, and I learned it fairly quickly, was that I love deer hunting and I love fishing, but I've realized quickly that there's some guys out there who I always refer to them as the Brett Favres and Michael Jordans of deer hunting, and the guys who really are good at it. I mean, they might not be able to tell you what kind of tree species their stand is located in, damn, they know how to hunt. They're predators. They're guys that really lock on to stuff, and they sense stuff, and they can't even put it into words sometimes. I mean, I've seen many examples of that. You ask them questions about, what are you seeing here? What are you looking at here? What made you sit in that tree? And they struggle to explain it. It's really interesting. So I guess what I'm saying is I've never considered myself the expert. I always consider myself the guy who can talk to experts and kind of interpret stuff and read research. I mean, I've always liked, and this is, I think, an odd thing, I've always liked sitting in conferences where these graduate students and deer researchers present their findings, and then interviewing them afterward and asking questions about things I didn't understand, because I just find it interesting the things they can they can learn about whitetails, scientifically, but then also realize there's some things about deer that we'll never fully understand. Because the thing I talk about, and I think a couple of these different articles I wrote for Meat Eater, is that, like, when it comes to the scents, one of the reasons I call you is because I really over time realized that Mark Kenyon is a real nice hardcore. Practical way of deer hunting, where he doesn't read too much into things that he can't really nail down. But boy, he knows his strengths, the weaknesses, and how to apply them. And I always find that's really important. The best deer hunters typically know how to put stuff, you know, in the use out there in the woods. So, but to answer your question, I've been stumbling around here with that. But to answer your question, I one of the reasons I called you on that recent one about interpreting, you know, what deer can smell and how well they hear, how well they see. I ask you these kind of questions. I like to hear what you think. And we talked just recently about how well do deer hear, and where do you rank that? And when you said that you rank, you know, their ability to smell as number one, I thought, yeah, I can buy that. I've seen it too many times where deer can just pick off a little bit of scent when you think, how the heck could they have smelled that? And even hear hunters talk about, well, do they have a sixth sense? Because there's no way they could have smelled me. And the thing that I find fascinating about, there's no way, when people say there's no way they could have done this or that, I think you're really not really taking account the many things that can go awry in the deer woods. You know, the way that a scent can swirl around and move in a direction that you don't expect. You know, just because the wind's blowing in your face in the tree stand you're in doesn't mean that 30 yards down the hill it's catching a little eddy and swirling back up in a way that they can pick up just a little bit of a scent off you, and actually may not be able to pinpoint you, but get pretty close to knowing whatever it was, this isn't good, and they start getting spooky. So anyway, I agree with you. When you I don't sit there and try. I think you probably figured out from my interviews, I don't try to steer you into what I think. I want to hear what you think. And so when you said that, I thought, yeah, that's kind of the way I think too. That, you know, number one is the scent, and then from there, I look at. You made this third point that I just loved, was that, and from there, if they see something or they hear something, the first thing they're going to try to do is verify it with their nose. If they can do it, they're going to verify it with their nose. And I thought, yeah, I've seen that too many times to not agree with that. Mm-hmm. So that's where I guess we and I agree on that pretty wholeheartedly, that it's scent number one. And then probably I'd say I couldn't tell you for certain if with sight or hearing, because I've been busted so many times by both.
Yeah.
But the one that I am just fascinated by how, with the hearing, the way that I've always loved watching deer's ears, the way they turn. And I remember that's probably the first thing when I saw a deer at close range when I was like maybe 15, 16 years old, hunting from a tree for the first time and looking down that deer and watching it approach. That's one thing I noticed, was those ears were just constantly moving, constantly checking things out. So I guess I kind of lean toward the ears as being number two, but they're so good at detecting movement that I don't discount that either.
Yeah. Yeah, they certainly have got a heck of a package of tools to survive between those three senses.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
Let's focus on smelling first, on their sense of scent. I know you've done a lot of research, not necessarily research, but read about a lot of research, and also been out there in the field and seen a lot of things that I'm sure have indicated to you that they have an incredible sense of smell. But does anything stand out as you've talked to different experts about their sense of smell or different researchers? Anything that stands out to you that helps kind of communicate just how unique their sense of smell is or how they smell? I mean, it's one thing to say they can smell really good. It's another thing to quantify that in some way or to help us try to understand that. What stood out to you when you've examined that?
Yeah, the guy I almost always interview at some point on these kind of topics is Grant Woods down at Missouri. Yeah, I know you've had Grant on your podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I really value greatly is my own credibility. I mean, I don't go off and I really make an effort to quote people accurately. And I take, and if I screw up, I admit it, and I find a way to correct that. But one of the guys I've always respected, because he's just a real, again, a down-to-earth guy who understands this stuff and reads more about it. And Grant not only comprehends it better, he remembers the details. I tend to forget all the little finer details, but Grant doesn't. But Grant made a great comment to me for this recent Meat Eater article where he he said something to the effect that deer can specify the age, the amount, and the origins of each meat, vegetable, seasoning. If you get a casserole dish, he made this great point where he said, you have a casserole dish cooking up there in your kitchen, and you'll take a whiff and go, my mom's making casserole or my wife's making casserole. Whereas a deer can get that same whiff and basically specify how much meat's in there, where it came from, what animal it grew, maybe even the age of that meat, it came out that animal, the seasonings in the dish. And they can gauge things like the temperature of that stuff as it's cooking in there, and how it's distributed, and whereabouts exactly in the house it's coming from without ever having stepped foot in there. And so I think they just have that, and I don't think Grant's exaggerating. I think they really have, when you look at how many scent receptors they likely have in their nose, and all these factors that go into it. That the one thing I loved about this piece on for Meat Eater, when I got writing about this, was it's cool to me to think that we have really nailed down things like the dogs, and dogs. Dogs have so much practical application for humans. We use dogs in so many different ways that there's been lots of research into what dogs can smell, how many scent receptors they have in their nose, and then but then we don't really have that for deer, because deer, as much as we enjoy hunting them, they don't have the practical application in the field. It's police work, tracking down suspects, whatever it might be, that dogs do. So you look at a human nose. And they figure that the human nose has anywhere from 10 to 50 million scent receptors in there. That each scent receptor is kind of a specialized little unit that can detect different scents, just one specific scent. But we have so many of them, it gets this whole array of scents that we can kind of distinguish. And most of us can point to someone in our life that can smell better than we can. Like in my case, I would look at my wife, and my wife can pick out odors and scents and tell you what vegetable it is and those kind of things. I always struggle with that. But, if you figure if the human has 50 million scent receptors, and you look at a bloodhound, they have some estimates up to 4 billion scent receptors in their nose. So when you put a bloodhound on a human track, they figure out real quickly, the direction of travel, which comes into play when someone tries to double back on a bloodhound. The bloodhound instantly figures out which scent, which part of that foot track is, which footprint was made most recently. They can tell that just by smelling it, what's the hottest scent. So that's, I guess, where I just love that kind of stuff. I love reading about and interviewing people who have done these tests and figure out how these dogs are able to smell so well. Then going back to Grant Woods again, so I asked Grant, well, what do you think can smell better? We don't have that kind of pinpointed information on a deer scent receptors. You haven't mapped out the deer's nose to know what part of that nose is smelling this, what part of the nose is smelling that. And Grant made this great point. He said, if deer can't smell better, can't detect scents better than a dog, how would they have survived all these eons in a world where they're being hunted by coyotes and wolves? They must be able to smell better than those creatures if they're able to evade them for this long and actually, survive despite heavy predation in some cases.
Interesting point. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of you guys are familiar with the old hunting tradition of eating, some organ, the heart or a chunk of liver off the first animal you kill. I had that when I was a little kid, and it was a big deal. Organ meats were always prized by frontier people who knew the importance of getting a lot of different minerals and nutrients. And as often is the case, those guys were onto something, because organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. And you can get the same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil, made exclusively from regeneratively raised, grass-fed, and finished cattle. Heart and Soil's unique freeze-drying process means all those important nutrients are trapped in, ensuring you experience every one of the benefits of nature's superfood in a clean, convenient, taste-free capsule. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And make sure to use code MeatEater for 10% off your purchase. That's heartandsoil.co. Use the code MeatEater. Hey guys, turkey season is in full swing right now, and if you are planning on getting after it, make sure to pick up some MeatEater Phelps turkey calls to stuff into the old turkey vest or into your fanny pack right now. I carry a few different things. I like to use mouth calls, and I like to use pot calls. Mouth calls or diaphragms, I like them because it gives you hand-free calling, meaning when you're working a bird up close, you can have your gun on your knee, finger on the trigger, ready to roll, and still be making turkey sounds. I like pot calls, so I just like pot calls. I enjoy calling with a pot call. Whatever direction you go, including a box call, which I don't personally use too much, but they're fun and great, and I started out with them. Yanni, on the other hand, one of my main turkey hunting buddies, he loves box calls. And what's funny is I'll now and then look to him and give him the look that means get out your box call and find us a turkey. So it's not that I don't like him. I just have Yanni use his. Then I don't have to carry it. Go to Phelps Game Calls. Get calls that are made in the USA and get calls that'll get them close. Find yours at PhelpsGameCalls.com today.
Given that, and we know this, what's the right way to describe it? We know this intellectually as humans. We know they have this tremendous level of scenting ability, but then oftentimes we still try to fight it. We still try to find ways to defeat a whitetail's nose. And you kind of have two schools of thought these days. There's one school of thought that says do everything you possibly can, and this is kind of what I typically err towards. You know, spray your stuff down, do the scent-free shower, store it outside, try ozone, try this thing, that thing. I try it all. At least you can maybe help yourself a little bit. And then the other school of thought is you're never going to 100% beat a deer's nose. Why even bother? Just focus on playing the wind right, and then it doesn't matter. What do you think? Where do you fall in that, Pat? Or where does your research point you towards when you talk to all these different people? Can you defeat it in any way? Is it even worth trying?
The point I make, and I do believe this, is that you can knock down your scent enough to where you confuse them, where you make them think you're farther away than you actually are. And I remember being able to pick up on that with my own two eyes, so to speak, back in probably like the mid to late 90s. And this is back when, I remember, Mark, this shows you, I'm really aging myself here, but one of my first trade shows I attended was probably about 1991 or 1992 when Scentlox first came out. And Greg Sussman was, the guy who founded the Scentlox company, he had like a little 10 by 10 booth at what was then the bow hunting trade show. And he was doing this test to kind of show people the technology he was using, where he put different scents in a jar and then covered the jars with his scent fabric, which in those days, it's fun to look back on that stuff. And I wish I would have kept Greg's original stuff, because they looked like basically dark pajamas. It was something like just something like the ninjas would have worn, maybe, so it's just the stuff you put these scent lock fabric pajamas on, and then put your hunting clothes over top of them. And one thing that I remember, a couple different times I'd be sitting on an edge of a field up in a tree, and you watch a deer way off in the distance often pick up its nose. They're downwind of you. They pick up the nose, and they just start waving that nose back and forth in the air, like you could tell they're confused. Like, they can detect something, but they're not alarmed. And I saw a couple different times where does and young bucks would work their way across that field, the nose in the air, sniffing, trying to figure out where that smell is coming from. They knew it was danger, but they weren't scared. They were more like curious, knowing they're getting, like they thought you're off in the distance, farther than you really were. And eventually they'd get within 200 yards, 150 yards before they'd start getting a little more antsy, where they're starting to think, this might not be good. But I thought, you know, God, in the past, though, you'd see that kind of behavior. And they just get that smell, get that scent and be gone. So I thought, you can't tell me it has no impact. Now, can you make it where you're invisible? No. That's, again, where I'm now in the modern era, quote guys like Mark Kenyon, because I think it was one of your great quotes in that article is that, you know, you just want to kind of make it to where you can't decide for sure what it is that's providing that extra little scent suppressing effort. But you can't pinpoint it. But you know if you do enough of these things, the shotgun approach, as you described it, I think I buy that. I've seen enough of it where I really get kind of testy when guys say, oh, that stuff's baloney, that doesn't work. I think, no, there's enough good science in there that's been tested by at universities like Rutgers and elsewhere, where the scent lock stuff, it does trap scent, it does hold scent, and you can reactivate the stuff to a point where it absorbs more scent. And so you can make a difference there. So I won't discount that. Where I think most hunters fail, and I put myself in this category, it takes real concerted, consistent effort to knock down that scent all the time. And whitetail hunters can do it because, you know, we can kind of pick and choose where we're going to hunt. We can kind of plan each stand time. Each time we sit in the stand, we can kind of plan for it and work around where it gets tougher to do, I think, in Western environments where you're moving constantly, you're spotting a stalk and you're glassing, all these kind of things. You're building up a sweat. It's much harder to control their scent in that setting than it is in a typical bow hunters in whitetail country.
Yeah.
So to me, all those kind of things factor into this. So I still try to spray down, you know, I use the scent killing sprays and that kind of thing, because I figure, what's the harm? At least you know, it doesn't hurt anything to try it. And I have seen these nice little tests that we do with the human nose, where people do have a harder time detecting things that have been sprayed down. And I figure, well, you know, you're basically playing percentages. You know, if you could have a choice between a 2% effectiveness and zero effectiveness, well, of course, you know, try the 2% or 3%. And any little edge at the right time in the right place and time might just be enough to make it work. So yeah. Why would you discount that?
Exactly. Definitely agree with that. Now, what about the latest trend in the scent control world, which is ozone, right? There was the Ozonics, and then there was Scent Crusher, and then there's all these other companies coming out with different ozone devices and stuff. Have you been able to talk to any researchers or see any science that backs that up? Anything in your research that points to how effective that is to any degree?
Not really. As you can figure out, anyone can figure out real quickly, is that it's hard to prove the effectiveness of this kind of stuff out in the field. And so, like, to me, I look at the ozone idea and that this these different devices that, Ozonics, I think, it makes sense to me. I mean, I guess the thing that convinces me, Mark, is when you can do a good practical example of how that stuff came to be. And I think the story they use, and it makes sense to me, is it was developed apparently by a guy who was he like a veterinarian or working on or doing necropsies on dead animals, and used this ozone to make it so it wasn't quite so stinky over the operating table or over the examining table. And by blowing this ozone across the table and killing that scent or whatever it does, destroying that scent, you know, you think, well, you know, I can see where if you could put a device like that, position it over your head so that as it blows off from the tree stand, it's disrupting your scent distribution. And I guess the way I look at it is during my Navy days, I remember taking all these FOSS firefighting classes, and they always talked about this foam they use in firefighting. It doesn't really put the fire out, but it keeps the oxygen from reaching the flame, so then it effectively smothers it. It cuts it off. I think, well, if you can do that in a scent stream with ozone, it makes sense. But as far as, you know, when you try to prove this stuff, that's where it gets tricky because, you know, there's so many different factors that come into this. You know, if you don't point that thing downwind cor- correctly, or if your scent goes off a different direction, then the ozone's blowing out. And then they, so there's always little things that are very hard to prove scientifically and consistently. And there's so many little factors that come into that testing process that disrupt things enough to where you can't get always the firm conclusions that we'd all like to have.
Yeah, so true. But like you said, it does seem like it's another one of those things that intuitively, or at least when you're out there experientially, it does seem to help to some degree. At least I've seen it.
It seems
to help. But like you said, there's a whole lot of what ifs and buts, and you know, there are a lot of ways it could go wrong too. But yeah, I think
that's where I again, as a reporter, coming out from a reporter's point of view, that's why I think it's important for me to talk to people like you. I ask guys like Greg Miller what he's come across. Greg's always been a pretty good straight shooter. I've known him for about 30 years. Grant Woods. I talk to different people, and they don't always want to be quoted on various stuff because of various requirements they have with sponsors or whatever it might be. But you know, eventually, if you talk to enough people, and they trust you enough to tell you what they really think, and then you can kind of at over time, I think. I always believe in the idea that facts aren't really disputable. You can't have. I don't believe in alternative facts. I believe in facts.
Yeah.
And when you get to a point where you've interviewed enough people, you've read enough of the literature on it, and you make some conclusions that here's the facts and here's the BS. I find myself over time the people I really trust. That I feel like I can share their insights and feel confident that I can fall back on the information they provide to back up arguments if someone disputes them. Those are the people I keep going back to because I figured they've done enough on this. They have enough experience to where and plus they just day in, day out tell the truth. I go with those folks and I stand by them.
Yeah. What do you think then when you think back on people like that or research that you've been reading up on? Let's shift from smell now to sight.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a recent movement in the sight world where people are like, camo's for the birds. You don't need camo. You can hunt in whatever. I'm curious what you've seen when it comes to the science of deer sight. And what that mm-hmm. should inform us as hunters, or how that should inform us as hunters. What stands out to you about deer's vision, and why and how mm-hmm. might it be important to us as hunters to know that?
Yeah, that's you and I are probably reading the same stuff and hearing from the same people and at least hearing the same arguments from different folks. And the thing in the bottom line, where I always start with when it comes to the deer vision, is their ability to see motion. They can see motion so well. Humans see motion really well. As I recall, from what they can figure out with I think it's called like the flicker effect or something, that it really to see movement and then quick respond to it as you're moving yourself. Deer have been able to test this, that deer can see as they're moving through the woods. They can see things and respond to it, or interpret it, whatever you want to call it, analyze it, like 2.5 times faster than humans can.
Wow.
So that, which probably explains why they can run through the woods and not poke their eye out all the time. If we ran through the woods at the speed, at even our fastest speed, which is nowhere near what a deer's is, we'd probably be jamming we'd probably lose our eyes in no time. You think how tough that is to negotiate stuff where you're not constantly ducking your head and seeing stuff coming. Well, deer, I've killed a lot of deer in my life, and I've yet to find a deer that poked out eye. Now, that's amazing. I find scars on them at times, but then you don't know if it got from jabbing into a branch or jabbing from a buck, whatever it might be. Another thing that I remember too, Mark, again, this speaks to my age, but I remember reading all the time as a kid growing up that deer see black and white. That's all I can see is black and white. And that was really the common belief back in probably well into the 70s, and probably even the early 80s was probably still people thinking that deer basically see black and white. And then Carl Miller at the University of Georgia and some of his students started looking into it and realized, no, they can see some colors. But the thing that Carl Miller will still talk about to this day is that where we get into trouble all the time, we can analyze how many cones, how many rods are in the deer's eye, what we think they can see. But one thing we can't do with deer, we can't actually ask them. We can't put like those little grids. If you've ever taken a color vision test, anyone entering the military takes this color vision test. Now, I always remember my color vision was fine. Every little chart they flipped over, I could identify the little number, hidden number in these pictures. Whereas guys with certain color vision problems can't see those numbers, and they'd get blackballed. You know, they couldn't go in.
That's me.
And you have that problem, huh?
I've got a little bit of red green color deficiency or blindness. Yeah.
Yeah. So like guys like you are the ones they'll kind of refer to as they'll say, well, if there's one color blindness that might line up with what a deer color blindness is, it's that one that you have. But the thing they get tricky about, where they get a little more careful about, is they'll say, yeah, but what we don't know is what the deer brain is interpreting from what it's seeing. And that's where humans, we know damn well what humans are interpreting, because we ask them, you know, can you see this? And you say yes or no. Well, how do you prove that with a deer? You can't just put a bunch of flip charts in front of it and start saying, tell us which one, do you see the number 3 in this picture?
Yeah.
You know, you can't do that with deer. So it's really always open to interpretation. Until we can find a way to test deer to pick out those little things, it does get tricky. But at Georgia, they have developed some tests, and they have shown that, deer, for example, they think see like the blue shades like 10, 18 times better than humans can. Maybe more than that. I haven't realized all the details in that, but they can see blues really good. They can see into the UV spectrum, but they can't see into the infrared spectrum. And so they have all these different things that they think they know based on the structure of the eye. Because one of the cool things about when they break down the things in the deer's eye, the thing that you always kind of rely on is that nature wouldn't provide that particular filter or that particular number of rods and cones unless the deer is able to use them. You know, nature's so efficient that way. So chances are, if it doesn't have, like we have this yellow filter in our eye that helps us break down detail. We can see detail really clear. You know, when you talk about 20/20 vision, that means, you know, good, solid vision that, almost everyone who sees 20/20, that basically indicates this is what you should see at 20 yards or 20 feet. 20 feet, I think it is. Whereas deer, they figure their acuity, their ability to see that fine detail, is only about a third of what ours is. So they figure, well, you know, they really don't need that to see the fine detail that humans require. So they don't need that. So they don't have that yellow filter. And plus, that yellow filter apparently it filters out like the ultraviolet lights, which for our lifespan, we live a long time. That's important to have. If we didn't have it, we'd probably go blind at some point. Where a deer, they don't live that long, so they don't have that yellow filter. So there's always cool things that they're able to look at, but still the thing they can't do, like I said earlier, is they can't flash pictures in front of a deer's eyes and then have them tell us what they see.
So the big takeaways on vision, or the things that we think we kind of know, are they've got a better than average ability to see blues. So don't go out there wearing a blue ball cap or blue jeans or something like that.
Right.
They don't necessarily have the level of attention to or ability to see detail, but movement is so key for them. So again, like my grandpa told me when I was a little kid, stop moving, Mark, stop moving. That's the case still.
Yeah.
Keep it slow, yeah. Right?
And another fascinating thing about why we can get away with so much more up in a tree stand than you can in the ground is, you know, the way their eyes designed. We have a round pupil, so we can see above and below us pretty good, you know, without really moving our eyes around a whole lot. We can be that good up and down vertical vision, where a deer lives full time on the ground it's been preyed on by four-legged predators all through its eons. So it doesn't really need that ability to see upward as much as like some animals might. But the deer does not see above quite as well as we can. And so you can get away with stuff. I mean, yeah, they get better above. Once they know they're being hunted from above, they'll cock their head up there and look that way more often than a deer that's not tuned into that. And that's why you see areas where they might hunt a lot. When they've been hunted a lot by from tree stands, yeah, they definitely do look up more. But as far as just walking through the woods, unless they actually make a conscious effort to look up, you know, they don't see that stuff up above them as well as we can. So those kind of things they're able to, you know, pinpoint based on just the structure of the deer's eye and try to gauge, well, what's it good at, what's it not good at, and what colors does it see better? And another one that comes into play is the fact that their eye is really well built for the time of day they're most active. You know, and that's right at the edge of day, you know, dawn and dusk. And their eye picks up I think it's in the blue spectrum again. Those blue spectrum lights that gets reflected like underneath the tail, for example, gives off a light that's in the blue spectrum. So when they're running through the woods and the mother's got its tail up and their fawn's following it, they can pick that white tail up really well from the light that's being reflected off of it. And so those kind of things are, I love reading about that stuff. And then I end up always, you know, thinking, well, you know, what can we do to beat that? And I think, well, you always come back down to the thing you just mentioned. Sit still, Mark. Yep. It's still going to be the number one thing.
Yeah, I think I need one of those like wrist bracelets or something, or put a little piece of paper on my bow riser the top of my visor, my hat that just says "Sit still, Mark." That would be a good a reminder all day, every day when I'm out hunting.
Because it's just a basic thing you're taught from the time you first hunt, but damn, it's hard to do it. You know,
yeah.
It's hard to sit there and have that discipline and not. And what kills me all the time is they always tell you, don't snap your head around when you hear a sudden noise.
Yeah.
I think, I've never been able to stop myself from snapping my head around.
Easier said than done.
Maybe that's why I'm not. It's just it's kind of an instinct.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of that then, right, you hear this snap. We sense that it's over our right shoulder. We spin our head to see it. We had some directional acuity with our hearing. We can kind of tell where sounds come from. Moving now to how deer hear, they have that even more, to an even higher degree than we do. And you brought this up a little bit earlier, but that seems to be like the superpower when it comes to deer hearing. Maybe not necessarily they can hear 10 million times farther than us, but they certainly can detect the source of sound better than us, right?
Yeah. They have that ability when they can turn those ears toward the sound of a source, or if their ears are pointed that direction when they hear it, they can lock on real quickly. And almost every deer hunter I know can tell a story about doing something like when they're rattling antlers, or doing something that scares it, where a deer gets curious. Those deer will show up, you know, right on the spot almost of where you rattle from, or else they'll show up. I think you brought this point up. If they don't show up there, they'll show up downwind of that spot almost precisely downwind of it, where they know that's where that sound came from. Let me figure out how, you know, what it was before I commit myself here. And so that ability to, it's basically the idea of triangulating. And when you have those big ears, and you have them, you know, set apart, you know, what is it, about 5 inches apart up on top of their head, that gives it just enough, that three-dimensional ability to triangulate, that really it's powerful. You think, well, how we do pretty well ourselves with fixed ears. So think what a deer can do with these radar dishes atop their head.
Yeah. The thing for me when it comes to that I always try to remind myself, and I would remind other people too, is like when you are actively choosing to make noise. So if you are grunting or rattling, trying to attract deer to within shooting range, you better sure as hell believe that it could work. Because if you rattle and then after 10 seconds you don't see anything, and then you lose your focus,
great point.
You're going to get surprised a couple times with a deer showing up 10 yards away looking at you moving around your tree stand. So you better assume that, hey, they can, they're locked. After you make that noise, you better just make the assumption, okay, there's a buck, he's locked on, he's going to be within 10 yards of me, I better be prepared for that in case it happens. Because if you get lax at that moment, I've seen it too many times, you're going to pay.
Definitely. You know, that's, I think, where all these accumulative things of hunting and fishing come into play. You know, that confidence that it won't happen all the time. It might only happen a couple times a fall, but you better be ready when it happens.
Yeah.
And I think anyone who's ever gone fishing, and whether it's, you know, watching corks or trolling, whatever, if you don't have confidence that at some point that rod holder's gonna, there's gonna be a rod bucking in the back end of the boat with a fish on the other end, you know, you lose your focus, your mind wanders, and in those cases, that with trolling you can get away with that. But when you're like jigging for walleyes and you get lax, you get complacent and you lose your confidence, you're probably going to miss the fish. And so I think all these kind of things start adding up for people who hunt and fish a lot. They start realizing that this is a matter of, you know, like we were talking about earlier, that when we talk in terms of 1%, 2% success rates, those aren't unrealistic expectations, really. But if you're not ready and that 2% happens, you're going to miss your chance, and that happens all the time. So, you know, one of my favorite things I worked on years ago was an article for Deer and Deer Hunting magazine where a woman named Karen Dasher, I think was her maiden name, she did some great research on scrape visitation by bucks. And she found that only about, you know, 2% or 3% of visitations to an active scrape were happening during daylight. It might have been 5%, but wasn't a pretty low percentage of scrape visitations was occurring in shooting light. And so, you know, some people would read that and go, well, what's the point of sitting there if only 2% of your time sitting on that stand is a chance of a buck coming by? And think, well, if that's, you know, the odds you're dealt with, then it kind of speaks to the idea that you better be out there every chance you get sitting on that spot, because, you know, you might, if you're not there as often as you can be out there, you'll certainly, the odds then really go up to worse than 2%.
Yeah. There's certainly a lot to trying to just that confidence thing, just being out there and knowing that if you're doing something that you have faith in, you're going to do it a lot better. This comes like a self-fulfilling prophecy, and that applies to so many things when it comes to deer.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of you guys are familiar with the old hunting tradition of eating, you know, some organ, the heart or a chunk of liver off the first animal you kill. I had that when I was a little kid, and it was a big deal. Organ meats were always prized by frontier people who knew the importance of getting a lot of different minerals and nutrients. And as often is the case, those guys were onto something, because organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. And you can get the same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil, made exclusively from regeneratively raised, grass-fed, and finished cattle. Heart and Soil's unique freeze-drying process means all those important nutrients are trapped in, ensuring you experience every one of the benefits of nature's superfood in a clean, convenient, taste-free capsule. Find out more at heartandsoil.co and make sure to use code MEATEATER for 10% off your purchase. That's heartandsoil.co. Use the code MEATEATER.
On the hearing thing, I remember reading something about you had mentioned that deer have the ability to, they have some kind of neural filtering ability with their hearing. Do you recall that? And what can you describe that?
Yeah. Neural filtering is basically the ability to, the deer, you know, because they live in their environment, you know, 24/7, 365 a year, they're out there. They hear sounds all day long that they can, eventually they figure out which ones to filter out, which one's not to filter out. And the best way I came up with to describe that ability in human terms is the idea that most of us have been in a loud environment, like at a cocktail party, and we're able to focus on the person in front of us and what they're talking to us about, and listening only to their voice and tuning out all the rest of the background noise. But then somehow in that process, though, we're listening. But if we hear our name mentioned, like a couple people away, or a certain phrase or certain words that are always of high interest to us, we somehow are able to pick out those noises, those sounds, and give them meaning and look that way. And deer, you think, well, they do the same thing out in the woods. You know, they hear a squirrel bouncing through the woods, or a possum waddling through the woods, or down south you get those armadillos. And eventually, you know, you think humans, how many times we've been hunting, we get pretty good at picking out all those sounds and differentiating them, but we still get tricked all the time, or we don't want to be tricked, so we look anyway. And so, you know, you can put a deer, they just, if they didn't have that ability, they would not last long. They would be basically nervous wrecks, because one of the truisms of deer that I always keep in mind, I make this comment all the time, is that deer are either scared or they're dead. If they're not in that potential, if they're not always in that frame of mind where they have to pay attention, they're not always paying attention. They can't afford to let their guard down like we do and get complacent. But yet, there's many times you see them just totally disregard certain noises. I doubt it's because they're complacent. I think it's just because they know this is not, they're so good at it. They identify that sound as non-threatening, and they just keep going about their business. And that's where I think in this article we talked about, you know, you and I got talking about, well, what's the best way to approach a stand when it's a dry woods? And that's when you mentioned that the idea, well, sometimes you're thinking that might be probably smart just to run to your stand or trot to your stand, a cadence that they just don't usually associate with people.
Right.
If you're sneaking in, you know, they probably a sound that they have learned. There's nothing safe about a sneaky human. And so they will pick that sound out every time.
Yeah, I've definitely tried to change up my cadences sometimes. When you know they're going to hear something, it's better not to sound like the steady, sneaky human. That's definitely something that I think. Now, another thing I feel like when we're talking about this ability to neural filter, you're able to pick the sounds that matter. Of course, there's going to be human, like sounds are so unnatural, like metal on metal, that kind of thing. I'm sure is something that they pick up on right away. But what about this one?
Yeah.
This is something that I've wondered about and seen, and that is other animals making warning noises. So let's say you are sitting in your tree and you happen to move and a squirrel sees you and just starts going off, starts chattering. It's like that warning. Or a bird, you're walking through and a crow starts crowing at you. Do you think there's any truth or validity to the fact or the idea, the theory that certain animals will make warnings that deer can pick up on and they interpret it as danger in some kind of way?
That's where I get nervous about making any hard and fast comment on something like that, because I have no way of knowing for certain. But I guess personally, I know it irritates the crap out of me and worries me when an animal starts doing that. When a squirrel starts chattering, a chipmunk starts cheeping, those kind of sounds, that worries me. I think, God, you know, how can another animal in the woods not take notice of that and figure if it's on a route that might take it somewhere close to me? Now it's probably having second thoughts, because it might not know, they might not have their own little language. But the thing, I say that just because logically I can't prove it. But then again, I always remember one of my little memories from childhood was my grandmother listening to a blue jay call one morning. And it's a certain call that blue jays make. And she goes, I guess it'll be raining later today. And I said, like, what? She says, That sound there, and his blue jay was made it again. She says, that call right there indicates that later today it's going to rain. And to this day, when I hear that particular blue jay call, God, it's usually been right.
Wow.
And but for me, the thing is, Mark, I couldn't begin to tell you what to right now imitate that sound to a point where you could understand it and where I could actually pass that knowledge along. So I think there is this knowledge that we can pass along through direct contact like that will always stick with us. But how do you communicate that to a fellow hunter in an article? And then, so that's where I don't discount the idea that that deer that lives in that environment 24/7 might be able to hear a little nuanced call that we don't get the nuance, but the deer does. And so that's where I can't discount it, because I can't say I've ever seen it myself. I doubt there's any scientists that can ever say they've pinpointed it. But I've talked to some guys that claim without a doubt that certain crow calls and certain squirrel calls alert deer and put them on edge. And I think I quoted this guy in my recent Meat Eater article on hearing, where he claimed the only time he was watching a buck one time in a bed, and the only time that buck picked up its head and focused on anything was when I heard a crow calling in the distance, and I locked onto that sound and looked that direction for the whole time the crow was squawking. So that, if assuming he's interpreting it right, well, chances are there was something out there that concerned that deer. If it concerned that crow, well, that concerned that deer. So I don't know. It's fun to talk about, and I guess I don't discount it.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what. I certainly use those sounds to alert myself to possibility of deer. So when I'm sitting in a tree stand, you hear that squirrel all of a sudden go off 40, 50 yards away in the brush, right away I key in on that spot. Because so many times I've heard a squirrel sound off the warning.
Right.
And if you watch it long enough, oh, there's the deer.
And that God, you know, I should have mentioned that, but I remember the first time I ever got a shot with my bow and arrow. I was 16 years old. This is like 1971 or 72. I think it was 71. I was up in this. And back in those days, we didn't have portable tree stands. You know, so typically we'd just find a big oak tree with a good horizontal branch and stand on it. And I remember watching this nice 8-point buck walk down this trail to me. My first indication that deer was anywhere around was a chipmunk started cheeping off in that direction. And I looked up that way, and I saw a little weird movement that I knew wasn't a squirrel or a chipmunk. And I watched a couple more times, and I finally realized it was a deer's nose. And it was eating, you know, it was browsing on some branches or some brush as it came through. But I always remember that was my first warning, my first indication that I had company was that chipmunk.
I think it's probably something that people ignore. But I think a lot of people, if you spend any amount of time in the woods at all, you'll eventually kind of get to know what an angry chipmunk or angry squirrel or that sound is.
Right.
And if you hear that sound, gosh, it pays to take a few minutes and scour that area with your eyes, because so many times they're not doing that for no reason. There's some kind of reason why they're making that racket, and often it can be an approaching animal.
And that's you're right. I can't imagine that crow is out there just squawking for its own entertainment.
Yeah,
something triggered it. You know.
Well, you know, it goes back to, and this informs so much of my deer hunting worldview and strategy now. It comes back to something that Craig Doherty once told me.
I
was sitting in a box blind with him up on his New York farm, and we didn't see any deer. That it was an evening sit. It was over a food plot. There should have been dozens of deer, and we didn't see anything at all. And I made a comment like, well, you know, it's deer. You just never know what they're going to do. And I just kind of passed it off as, you'll never know. And Craig said, no, that's the wrong approach. He said, you always need to ask why. There's always a reason why. And the key to getting better at this thing is whenever you observe something, or whenever something goes right or something goes wrong, or something happens unexpectedly, don't just take it for, oh, that thing happened, and move on. Observe whatever happened, and then ask why, and try to figure that out. And there's so often in the woods, when you see a buck walk from point A to point B, I always try to think to myself afterwards, why did he move from point A to point B? Why did he go in that direction? Why was he acting in that way? And I just, as much as I possibly can, I'm trying to ask that throughout my hunting season, throughout a hunt. And I can't tell you how many times that has helped me learn lessons. Constantly, there's a reason why they do everything. If we can pick even like five, if we can get the answer right 5% of the time, that helps.
I really respect that approach, because I've always figured that's one of the reasons that I'll never consider myself a great deer hunter. I'll never try to tell people that, well, listen to me, I know all there is, or I'm really the expert in this area. But I've met too many of these people I've met too many guys who really are that good. And the thing I think they all have in common is that curiosity, that ability to they might interpret it wrong, whatever it might be, but the fact that they're questioning it all the time and trying to put those pieces together all the time, that's what makes them so good at it. And you know, the things that I find interesting, it might not interest them in the least because it doesn't really fit into the puzzle they're trying to put together. Whereas, you know, like I can get myself distracted on any number of things out in the woods, mm-hmm. and I always think that's probably why I'll never be that great deer hunter. My mind tends to wander. I tend to look at other stuff and start being interested in a certain bird, where I find a feather and go, okay, and I'll start trying to figure out what bird that feather came right. from, instead of paying attention to sounds around me. You know, yeah. So I think these are all the things that that separate the women from the girls when it comes to hunters. You know, yeah. that there's. There's guys out there. I just I've learned over time that you don't get jealous of their success. You respect their success, because chances are that if they don't just stumble on me, everyone can stumble onto a good buck every now and then, or a good nice long string of success where they never come home empty handed year to year. But people who are good at this, who it really matters to them. They're out there all the time. They got their trail cameras going all the time. They're looking at the stuff in the trail camera. They're interpreting what they're seeing in there. It's always something that's it's tugging at them and inspiring them and sparking something. Where then there's the rest of us who want to attribute it all to luck and just good timing and fortunate timing. And I think just over time the good deer hunters find a way to separate themselves from the rest of us.
Yeah, what I appreciate about you is the. A, your humility, but B, the fact that you approach, it seems like, not only your writing, but also your hunting with a journalist sensibility, and that you're looking at things objectively, you're going to strong, trustworthy sources, and not falling for alternative facts, but being able to sort the facts from the BS. And I think that's a strong approach to writing and a very strong approach to deer hunting. And you certainly are doing that. So answer me this, though. You have been in the deer hunting world now for 30 or more years. You were editing for Deer and Deer Hunting magazine. You were now freelance writing for all these different outlets over the years. What is, maybe right now, I'm sure you, over the years you've seen a whole lot of new ideas coming and going, different trends rising and falling, different fads getting really popular and then dissipating. Can you name one of these ideas that you feel like is really legit? If there's one of these fads or new strategies or products or something that you say, you know what, I've seen that backed up enough, or enough sources have told me, or my own experiences have told me, this one is really legit. So one idea or little gimmick that actually is real. And then can you name one that is bogus? Is there something out there? Is there some fallacy, some myth that you just can't? You're so sick and tired of people spouting this BS, and you need to correct it right now.
I guess the one that I just can't get behind, and I just as Steve Rinella would say, if God came down and put a gun to your head, where would you stand on this one?
Yeah.
And that's the moon phase stuff. I can't get into it. I've tried many times over the years through surveys, through Q&As, through interviews, and reading as much research as there is on it. And I just always come back to the idea that Al Hofacker, again, the Deer and Deer Hunting founder, when they first looked into this stuff back with their readership surveys back in the 80s, Al's conclusion after going through all the different surveys that he reviewed, it's all a bunch of hooey. That was Al's conclusion, all a bunch of hooey. And then when Grant Woods, I thought, was just super cool to interview on this article I did for Meat Eater about the lunar phases, where he thought he had it nailed down. He thought he had it nailed down back in 1993, 1994. And we actually worked together on a project back then for Deer and Deer Hunting, where he had this chart, and then we were selling it through the magazine, and because he had like a 72% accuracy on it. And Grant was really proud of it. He was doing all this. He was actually giving seminars on it and giving presentations to the scientific community on it. And he had what looked to be really solid information that he had figured out how to link deer activity to the moon's different things about how far above the equator it was on certain days and when it rose, when it sat, all these kind of things. And then he said, but then it all fell apart with the GPS collars. He said, once they put GPS collars on deer and they knew where they were 24 hours a day and if they're moving, if they're sitting still, he said, my deer activity indexes fell apart. And I always took that to heart that, well, if Grant Woods could go from this point where he thought he was, you know, and he's a pretty smart, skeptical guy, to go from where he thought he had something figured out to where he's now just, you know, doesn't even consider it. He just goes hunting. I figure, well, I'm probably more in that camp, you know, where it just seems like it's just too hard to quantify. But then I get back to where I think, on their hand, I don't discount the idea that if it gives a guy confidence that he's got to figure it out and that keeps him on stand, it puts him out in the woods when other guys might stay home.
Yeah.
I don't know. I have a hard time discounting that belief. And
yeah.
I don't think the belief is making the deer move at a certain time, but I do believe it's helping the guy stay out there. And so that's where I don't totally just, get all judgmental about it. If some guy swears by it, I'm not going to argue with them. I just figure, well, the thing is, Mark, again, I'd say, well, on the other hand, I look at that and I'd look at what's on his wall and what he's accomplished as a hunter. And I think, well, he's doing something right.
Right.
so I just figure, well, whatever it might be, that might not be it, but he's doing something right.
Yeah.
As far as things I find where it's valid, where it has credentials, I guess the two things that I still think scrape hunting is always worth a shot. If you've got some good scrapes that indicate a buck's moving through a certain area on a regular basis, I don't know about how often they come by and check the scrape, or how often they happen to walk on the same trail or near the same trail that where they rubbed, a nice long rub line along some ridge. But there are certain things that I think you can piece together from deer sign, obvious deer sign, that still it's hard to overlook and discount. And that's where, like Greg Miller, I think in one of his books on, I think it was me, Rubline Secrets, one of those, I think he estimated something like only about 5% or 6% of his attempts at killing bucks in a rub line have ever worked out. There's just very few times it works out. But he said, again, it's worked out enough times, though, to where he keeps trying to piece them together and hunt over them. And so, that's to me worth hanging on to. And but then you have to, at some point, I remember Greg years ago kind of giving up on trying it up north in Wisconsin because baiting became so popular. And once you have deer responding to outside stimulus, in this case, artificial food sources, well, it throws off all those natural patterns that he was used to capitalizing on.
Interesting. I think I feel like a lot of what you said rings true with me as well. When it comes to things like scrapes and rubs, none of these things are surefire, guaranteed type setups, but it is something. It is a piece of the puzzle, and it's certainly better to be working with a piece of the puzzle versus a blank slate. And I think it can help with that confidence too. And you make up mm-hmm. you make an interesting point that the placebo effect, just believing something might help you, actually can help you because you're confident. And if you're confident, you're focused. And if you're focused, you're on point, and you mm-hmm. take advantage of things when those opportunities arise. And you can't discount that. So that is a really good point. And it's interesting to see how that might play out in the woods.
Yeah, thank you.
I think that this is a good place for us to wrap it up, Pat, because we've covered some really helpful kind of, I think, foundational pieces of knowledge for new hunters and then even for experienced hunters. I think it's good to go back and look at the building blocks and remember, what do deer do? How do they see the world? How do they perceive the world? What does that mean for us as hunters? That just can't be hammered into our heads enough, I think. So I appreciate you taking the time to share the things you've learned over the years as you've hunted and learned through your own experiences and then, learn from so many of the people out there, your ability to find and interpret things from sources out there and sharing that with the rest of the world, I think is very helpful. And I will say to the folks listening, start paying attention to the byline. And when you see Pat Durkin on the byline of an article, you can feel confident. This isn't a placebo effect. You can feel confident that you're about to read a quality piece of work. So Pat, thank you for doing this. And I hope a lot of people will read what you're doing. And I know that I've enjoyed everything on the Mediator recently. And I'm really glad that you're helping us out there.
Great. Thanks, Mark. I'm flattered.
Yeah, I hope you have a great hunting season this year too.
Yeah. When's your first hunt?
I leave in like 2.5 weeks for early September hunt in North Dakota.
Very cool. Good luck out there.
Thank you. All right, Pat, we're going to wrap it up.
And that will be a wrap for today's episode. Hope you enjoyed this one. I will give you a couple quick suggestions, though, before you go. Number one, if you want to follow along with the hunts that I've got coming up, I'm leaving in just a matter of weeks for my first hunt, and then it will just be chaos from there on out. If you want to follow along with everything I'm up to, make sure you are following Wired to Hunt on Instagram. And finally, if you've been enjoying this show, I haven't asked for this in a while, but I'll throw it out there. If you've been enjoying the podcast, it would be incredible if you could leave a rating or review over on iTunes. That would mean the world, and it really helps us out. So, that way, thank you for listening. Thanks for being a part of this community. And until next time, stay wired to hunt.
After 3 years of work, our follow-up to the Meat Eater Fish and Game Cookbook is here. It's the Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook, wild game recipes for the grill, smoker, campfire, and camp stove. Here is your book for everything that's best cooked or eaten outside, from grilling to open fire cooking to Dutch ovens to smokers to barbecue to backpacking meals to how to pull off the perfect fish fry, with pit stops along the way for lessons about ice age cooking methods and the best 5 ways to construct a cooking fire you can be proud of. And of course, we're focusing on wild game and fish here with over 100 recipes, including stuffed venison burgers 3 ways, wild duck with aji verde sauce, a jerky made with cola, a gin and tonic made with fire charred lemons, and grilled frog legs made with a sticky sweet sauce. This ain't your normal cookbook, so be prepared to be surprised. Get your copy now. For more info, visit TheMeatEater.com or buy it wherever books are sold.